Welcome to another episode of the Gay Bar Archive Show, where we explore gay history one bar at a time. I'm your host, Art Smith, and today our guest is Kathy Renna, Communications Director of the National LGBTQ Task Force and a principal at Target Q, a marketing and PR firm specializing in LGBTQ issues and media. So welcome to the show, Kathy.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
And it's great to have you. You've got a pretty long and rewarding history in the LGBTQ field, formerly known as the gay world. And and I just want to talk about some topics with you and kind of get a feel for your background in the gay scene itself. And then we'll talk about your professional life as well. So what defunct gay clubs had the biggest influence on you personally and or your career path?
It's a good question. You know, I came out in, I mean, I came out as an activist. I became more active in the community in the late 80s. I mean, it was really when I was in college that I started to go out to bars, and I went to Adelphi University on Long Island. So there were a couple of bars on Long Island, but mostly we wanted to go into Manhattan. And my favorite haunts in Manhattan were the Duchess, which is right across from the Stonewall Inn, because it was a women's bar. And also the Click Club, which was over in the Meatpacking District before it became cool. It was actually quite scary. There was no sign. There was like always a very large woman bouncer. And then there was a little red light at the top that's how you knew where it was. And it was this weird cavernous underground thing. But it was awesome because it was really out there. I mean, there was music, different kinds of music on several different levels. They would have, you know, one room where they were just showing porn 24/7. It was wild and it was great. It was very freeing. I mean, I grew up with a very accepting family. I was very out. I had no qualms and a ton of support around being a lesbian, but it was really quite freeing to be able to, you know, be close to places where you could just be yourself, whether it was dancing or drinking or, you know, really, you know, just sitting back and watching the party, which is mostly what I did at the Click Club.
Now, from my experience, which of course is mostly from the men's bars, most of the lesbian bars that I knew about tended to be a little bit more, almost underground and smaller.
Yeah.
They were kind of like neighborhood bar size, you know, not huge. Were the Duchess and the Click Club like that as well? Were they
The Duchess was fairly small. I mean, it's a Starbucks now. So like we know exactly how big it was because it's same building, same, you know, basically, you know, the size of the Starbucks on the corner across from the Stonewall Inn on Christopher Street. But the Click Club was big. It was multi-level. When I moved to D.C. shortly after, I moved to D.C. after I graduated college. And then I went to a ton of clubs in D.C. and Trax was really the big, big club. Trax was awesome. And it wasn't multi-level, but it was just ginormous. Had an outside, had like three or four different huge areas, again, different kinds of music. And I think it was, you know, typical. I think we had like the second Tuesday of the month was lesbian night, right? So they would have us, you know, on that one night of the month. Not that we couldn't go other nights, but that was, you know, women's night, ladies' night, whatever. And that was a huge club. So that was always really fun and freeing. But all the other ones, especially in DC, like the Phase, my God, the Phase was tiny. I mean, I've lived in apartments bigger than the Phase. I mean, the dance hall, the dance floor was, you know, it was, you know, maybe, I mean, not much bigger than some people's dining room tables. Like it was really tiny. But across the street was Hill Haven, which was on the second floor. And it had a decent sized dance floor and an actual like bar, like a big square bar. And so you could sit around the bar and there were tables and, you know, it was like a little roped off VIP area. So Hill Haven was really popular for a long time. It wasn't open for as long as the Phase. And then there was the Hung Jury, which was kind of in between. The Hung Jury was in a very weird spot. It was like by K Street, downtown, where all the offices were. And it was underground, literally underground. Like you had to go down underneath a parking lot. And that was, you know, again, it was like decent size. There was a good size dance floor, several hundred, you know, people could fit there. And the Hung Jury was actually best known for being somewhat hostile towards men who came. Like the Faze, if you brought your gay best friends, you know, it was fine. Hill Haven, same thing. The Hung Jury was not quite as friendly.
I've heard that before from other lesbian mm-hmm. establishments across the country. And usually the reasoning I've heard for it, or at least the excuse they gave, was that they were trying to protect their patrons from straight men who might masquerade as gay men so they could come and feel up the lesbians.
Oh, definitely. I mean, I saw that a lot. There would be couples that would come, you know, looking for a third, you know, a straight couple or mixed sex couple, I guess. Who knows what orientation they were. Someone had to be bisexual, right? And so that was not uncommon. And I think you're right. I think that's probably why the Hung Jury especially was really mindful of that. I mean, any of these other places, like if you're a guy and you're at the Duchess and you hit on a girl, you'd be out of there so fast your head would swim. And somebody much bigger than you was yanking you out. You know, I mean, they had serious, I guess you'd call it security, bouncers, whatever, at the Duchess especially.
Now, around that time frame, in a lot of cities, the men's bars tended to be somewhat exclusionary. And by that, I mean, they tended to be kind of homogenous in the type of men that they attracted. So, yeah. For instance, in Atlanta, I used to go to a bar called the Far Library. It was kind of a upscale men's bar. You know, most people, you would never walk in there with tattered jeans and a t-shirt. Mm-hmm. Right. Wouldn't even feel comfortable. But it never occurred to me until just recently that it seemed like 90%+ of the people I would see there would have always been white gay men. Mm-hmm. Was that the same way in the women's clubs, where the Duchess and the Clit Club typically all white or all black, or were they... Was the lesbian community more?
Right, not as much. I mean, I think that's partially because there just weren't as many, you know, venues for lesbians. And also because, I mean, I'll just be frank. I don't think it was a level of bias. I mean, I still see it, you know, in parts of the male community, gay male community. I mean, there were incidents not too long ago, like last year in Philadelphia, where black queer men were not allowed into a bar. They had like a no Timberland shoes rule, which pretty obviously racist. So I think that's always been an issue. But, you know, the Duchess actually was primarily African-American women. But they were always open to anyone who would come in. I used to go all the time with my girlfriend at the time. And, you know, we'd always joke that the best compliment we would get is like, they're like, you dance really good for a white chick. So, you know, it's like it was a little different kind of scene. I will tell you that I used to go to men's bars quite a bit, partly because I had a lot of gay male friends and they used to tease me all the time because we used to always joke, like, be careful, like, don't go to the Eagle when it's like the lights are down, because I could easily be mistaken for a cute boy. One Halloween, my girlfriend at the time and I actually dressed up as cowboys with like real mustaches and the whole thing, like basically drag, male drag. Which is not too far, you know, a trip for me, just the mustache, really. And so we had guys hitting on us, like totally hitting on us. And we're like, wait a second, no, I have to pull my shirt up, you know. It's the guys' bars are a totally different vibe, you know. I mean, not that women didn't pick each other up. I mean, that certainly happened, but we cruise a little differently, I think, or at least we used to. I can't say I've been doing that for a long time. So it's been a while. I'm an old married lady now.
Well, for the gay male community back then, you know, from my experience and my observations of other people's experiences, the hookup was the thing. It was, you know, in fact, in a given weekend, you might go out, you know, you probably would go out every night because everybody went out every night back then. But you also would probably pick up a different guy every night. In the male scene, but
you have to tell me, I would see it up and down P Street. I mean, there are all the gay bars up and down P Street on 17th Street in DuPont Circle. Absolutely. Yeah.
In the lesbian scene, the joke was always, yeah, on the second date, you get a U-Haul. So it was like, you need somebody to get married.
Yeah, that totally happened.
There's always been a little dichotomy about that aspect of it anyway, between the, you know, the gay male and the gay female scene. And I called my project Gay Barchives, and initially I got some flack from that because of the LGBTQ issue. And, you know, I quickly defended it by saying, when I came out, it was gay, period. If you were trans, you were gay. If you were lesbian, you were gay. You know, if you were a homosexual male, you were gay. There was no division in the community back then. It was, everything was gay. You know, the Gay Liberation Front was gay. It wasn't the LGBTQ.
In the 70s, sure.
So in my mind, gay just is kind of a blanket for the entire community. And now, of course, I noticed the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force changed their name to include LGBTQ. And I don't know if you're going to have to change it again.
We have. I mean, it started out as the National Gay Task Force. You realize that?
Right.
And then it became the Lesbian Task Force, and then it became the LGBT, and now LGBTQ.
But whatever it is, it's one community. And there's a lot of things that we've gone through together. And as you know, being an activist and a patron of the bars, back in those days, in the 70s, not that you would know that, but the 80s, the 90s, the gay bar scene played a huge role in building the community and all of the organizations. I mean, anyone I've spoken to who was involved in a major gay activism organization or gay rights organization has told me that they would not exist if it was not for the gay bar scene.
I think that continued well into the 80s and 90s. I didn't come out till the, you know, I was in college. I graduated from college in 1987 and I moved to Washington. But, you know, it that's when things started to change some, you know, and we only had the bars for a very long time. That was a place to find your tribe, and that was it. And I remember actually, not long after I moved to Washington, D.C., it was like the early 90s, and I wanted to get more engaged in the community. And the truth is, I wanted to do more than go to the bars. Like, I wanted to get involved and find something to do. And I'm also not a big drinker. So, I love to dance, go out and dance all. I'd go out and dance like, you know, every night, Friday and Saturday, every weekend. But it was, you know, you're right. I mean, they were a place where you could find community, you could feel safe, and you would not be alone. And for so many people for a long time, that's all there was. So I understand that.
Now, at what point did you start getting involved with GLAAD? Was GLAAD the first organization that you were involved with?
Yep.
About what time?
Yeah, it was about 89. And again, I was dating someone who was sober. So going to the bars was less, less attractive an option. I mean, also someone who liked to dance, but was not comfortable around so much alcohol. And so I said, look, let's see what else is going on, you know, and there was a panel discussion. And I'll never forget, the title of it was Lesbian Invisibility in the Media, which, because we were pretty invisible at the time. And one of the women on the panel was a woman named Ann Werner, who was the founder of the GLAAD chapter in Washington, D.C. And so, went up and talked to her after and said, you know, would love to help out, volunteer. When do you meet? You know, I mean, I'm talking about the days when we literally with a scissor would clip articles out of the newspaper, because this was like well before the internet. I got bit by the activism bug. And so I started volunteering for GLAAD. I started chairing a committee, and then all of a sudden I was co-chair of the chapter. And then over the course of the early 90s, GLAAD became a national organization. The chapters in Los Angeles and New York merged, and then the other ones merged into that. I ran the Washington, D.C. office for many years. And then when I became the first national news media director in 1999-2000, I moved back to New York, which is where I grew up. So I was with GLAAD for a very long time and through a lot of things, obviously.
Yeah, there were a lot of things going on in the 80s, 90s.
It was a busy decade for the queers, yes.
It was. There was so much going on. And it was really the beginning of us starting to get media recognition on any kind of a mainstream level at all. Prior to that, you know, I came out in the late 70s to myself. And, you know, there were no role models, no images, no concept of what a gay life was like. You know, I knew I was attracted to men. I was dating guys. I was sleeping with guys. But I had no idea that there was such a thing as a community or a lifestyle.
Yeah,
I just thought it was some, you know, strange anomaly that I was just going to have to figure out how to deal with. And then as we progressed, you know, into the, through the 80s, and of course the, I think the HIV epidemic kind of helped skyrocket that, you know, into public view because the media automatically connected that. In fact, if I'm not mistaken, it was originally called the gay cancer or gay-related immunodeficiency.
Yeah, GRID,
So it was automatically associated with the gay community. And that kind of helped solidify, I think, the community a little bit and also put out, you know, made a number of people come out to their families willingly or otherwise. And that kind of started the social discourse about, you know, where do gays fit into society?
Well, I think that, right. I mean, when you look at the history, it's really interesting. There's a historian, his name is John D'Amelio. He's a phenomenal person. And, you know, he's written a lot about this. You know, the first sort of real modern wave of gay and lesbian at the time, really, culture happened after World War II when, you know, gay and lesbian service people, particularly men, you know, found out that they were not alone. You know, they were shipped off and they went to war, but they met other gay people. And then they stayed, as you can see, in many port cities like San Francisco and San Diego and New York. And that was really like the first awakening in a way of community, mostly underground, right? I mean, I knew a gay couple, they lived above us in Brooklyn Heights when I lived in Brooklyn Heights. And they had been together probably about 60 years. They were in their 80s. I mean, they met during World War II. And it was really an incredible story. I mean, they had photos that, you know, they would only be able to, like, it wasn't film that you would send off, because if you sent off film of, you know, guys having fun in drag, you could probably go to jail. So that period was like the first step. And then, of course, the AIDS epidemic, you know, it is I guess the best way to describe it is an absolutely horrific silver lining, but it did, you know, vault gay visibility, particularly gay men. And it also did bring the community together. I mean, I know so many lesbians and trans folks and bi folks, you know, we rushed to the sides of our friends and family who were dying, many of them very young and many of them not out to their parents. I worked with the Family Acceptance Project for a very long time, my entire career, basically. And its founder, Dr. Caitlin Ryan, talks a lot about how she was working actually in Atlanta with Anthony Fauci in the early days of AIDS. And she would see these young men who would literally come out to their parents and tell them they were dying within the span of, you know, 10 minutes. And then she saw the impact of what would happen if that family accepted their child or if their family turned them away and rejected them. And that's what really inspired her to start the Family Acceptance Project. So, you know, it's fair to say we coalesced around the cause of AIDS and HIV. And then what started to grow out of that in the early 90s was when Bill Clinton got elected, especially the beginnings of the fight for marriage equality and also the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell and allowing, you know, LGBT people to serve openly in the military. And now we're in a, you know, we're in a very different place. I mean, the 90s were a time when we started to see a lot more visibility. The murder of Matthew Shepard, which got a tremendous amount of visibility. Ellen came out. We had more and more people literally coming out, you know, in the workplace and their families, and some more visibility in media. And then the late 90s, we saw an explosion. I used to joke that the summer of 2000 was the, you know, the summer of queer visibility. We started to see things like Queer Eye for a Straight Guy and Will and Grace and all of those things. And since that point, the focus has been really on trying to get more diverse representations. Because if you look prior, there, again, like kind of like the bars you talked about, you know, there are 90%, 95% gay white men. That's not what our community looks like, and that's not who we are. And so as a media activist and advocate, that's what I've been fighting for the last, you know, 25 years, is more visibility, but more diverse visibility.
So at what point did you transition from your role with GLAAD to the National Gay Task Force?
So there's a like a 15-year gap in there. So I left GLAAD in the early 2000s. I worked at a communications firm, a progressive firm called Fenton Communications, for a couple of years, which is very exciting. I got to work with some really amazing folks like Nobel Peace Prize winners and MoveOn.org, which was very big at the time, but also some LGBT clients. It was like 2005, 2006 that I really decided I wanted to step out on my own. And that was partly because I think I just wanted to focus almost exclusively on LGBTQ issues, because that's really where my heart is. And I wasn't able to do that at the firm. And also because my daughter was born in 2005. And I began to realize that if I was an executive at a small firm, I was going to be there 12, 14 hours a day. I was not going to see my daughter grow up. So I basically jumped off a cliff and started a consulting firm in 2006. And I did that up until, and I continue to do it actually on a smaller level, but I did that up until the end of last year. The task force is an organization I've worked with for my entire career on and off collegially. I go to the Creating Change Conference, the annual conference we have, which is this awesome queer activism conference with several thousand people. Last spring during COVID, when it was first starting, I was helping them with their Queer the Census campaign, which was a huge campaign. And, you know, we had to pivot entirely and go virtual. And in that time period in the spring, they lost their communications director. And so the executive director, Ray Carey, at the time, dear friend, colleague, said, would you be willing to serve as our interim communications director from now till the end of the year? We were in the middle of COVID. My clients were not doing anything. I mean, prides were all virtual. A lot less was happening. So I was like, sure, I'll have a real job for the first time in a long time. And I just love the organization. And so as we got toward the end of last year, they asked if I would consider becoming the communications director if I wanted to throw my hat in the ring. They needed somebody who was going to be a permanent in that position. And so I threw my hat in the ring, and here I am, you know, which is, you know, I would have never expected it. I think COVID was such a bizarre year, unlike any other, and so horrible in so many ways. But I feel very blessed that I've been able to come out of it, literally, with, you know, this position at the task force, with the chance to work on these issues at such an important time, and to, you know, flex my media muscles for an organization that really deserves to be incredibly visible because they do great work.
And sometimes some of those organizations get kind of lost in the shadows, because there's a couple, you know, like Equality or Human Rights Campaign that get all of the attention pretty much. I mean, you ask people to mention a couple of gay rights organizations, and they're usually going to be the same kind of answers. You're not going to hear about a lot of the organizations that may have been around longer and done more, but they just don't have the mass recognition.
I think that used to be more true. It's much less true now. I mean, I think if you look at who the media talks to, I mean, of course they talk to HRC. They're the largest, you know, queer organization, political queer organization in the country. The LA LGBT Center actually has a bigger budget. They're like the largest gay organization in the universe. God bless Lori Jean. But the task force is a very unique organization. We're the progressive end of the LGBTQ movement, and we are an LGBTQ organization that works closely with progressive organizations, whether it's around reproductive rights, racial equity, voting rights. So, you know, we're to the left, in, if you want to describe it that way, to HRC. But, you know, we all have a role to play, and we're all very diverse organizations. And, you know, I think that what we've seen is, you know, as you could, all you have to do is look on your computer or turn on your TV, much more visibility of trans organizations, of organizations that either completely serve communities of color or are, like the task force, have leadership who are African-American, Latino, and much more diverse than we've seen before. You know, I mean, it's really something to see the task force, HRC, and the National Center for Lesbian Rights all have an African-American executive director. It's the first time that's ever happened in our community. And I think that it's reflective of, you know, it's, again, more and more progress in really very intentionally representing our community in its full diversity, its full breadth.
Right. And, you know, I did an interview a couple of weeks ago with the director of our equality organization here, Equality Florida, which is Nadine. I've known Nadine for 25 years.
I love Nadine. And,
you know, she's at the top of that program, you know, leader of Equality Florida, and not only a woman, but a woman of color.
Yep.
And has been in that role the day it started, since the day Equality.
She has. And she's really not just a state level leader. She has a national reputation as an incredible activist. Nadine's an extraordinary person. I've known her for a long time as well. And, you know, she's saved a lot of lives with her activism. And she's really, you know, she's one of the hardest working activists in the business, as they say.
Yeah. And when I was talking to her, she had told me, you know, she lives maybe 15 miles from me. Mm-hmm. She lives in St. Pete and I live in Tampa. And she was telling me that, you know, through her bar experiences in Tampa, that Equality Florida would not exist had it not been for the Tampa bar scene, that mm-hmm. not only the financial support that they gave, you know, the organization, but also the meeting space and the place to do all their fundraisers, you know, because almost at that time, all the fundraisers were done by drag queens and bars, you know, that's the way it was. Now things have changed.
It's changed a lot, but yes, I could not agree. I remember in Washington, there was a group, still exists, called Brother Help Thyself, which I guess could best be described as like a gay leather United Way. They would give out grants, tons of grants. They would raise tons of money. And we would go for our grant hearings and applications and, you know, questions. We'd go to the Eagle, you know, and I'd be sitting underneath a hanging motorcycle, you know, surrounded by leather guys. And it was awesome. I mean, the leather community, the drag communities were key and critical to raising money in our community, and in many ways still are. Maybe not as visibly, but the Imperial Court does a tremendous amount of work.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, when we had the event where they buried Matthew Shepard at the National Cathedral, which I cannot think of another similarly historic event, frankly, in recent memory, the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence came because they're very supportive of the foundation, and the foundation loves them, and so they were there at the cathedral. Security was a little worried when they saw them coming. I'm like, no, they're with us. They're our friends. They're our people. We love them. They just look like scary nuns. And they came right into the cathedral. It was awesome.
I know.
You know, I think if you don't know the history, you don't appreciate that. You know, you don't appreciate how much of our community was really built on, you know, having a table at a bar and people donating money that would quite literally pay the rent for the GLAAD office or pay the phone bill for the GLAAD office. We did the same at Lambda Rising, but not every town or city is lucky enough to have a, you know, big, large gay bookstore like Lambda Rising was for us back in the 90s. So, you know, it's interesting because I think it's a very, you're right, it's a very different dynamic now. People do fundraisers, big fancy dinners and galas and all of that, but our roots are something that I feel like it's important people recognize and understand.
I agree. And when I started this project, you know, the first bar that I recorded was Backstreet in Atlanta, and that came out of a conversation with the owners of Backstreet, who are still in Atlanta, and we wanted to create a design to commemorate the 45th anniversary of the year they opened. They opened in 1975, so the anniversary would have been 2020. And even though they were closed by then, they wanted a design out there for people who were constantly talking about the bar and remembering the bar. And I said, well, let's do it as a fundraiser. You know, let's make the profits of the T-shirt go to a nonprofit. Mm-hmm. And she said, well, figure out who you think it should be and we'll talk about it. And I said, sisters of perpetual indulgence. And and she said, why? I said, well, they're a really good organization, but they're also an adult organization. I think it would be kind of weird to have the bar t-shirts raise money for, you know, homeless youth or something at that point when you're promoting this concept of, you know, memorializing a bar. I said, I felt like it should be more related to an adult type organization. And as it turned out, they were very successful. They got a lot of money out of it and they were very grateful. But a lot of people don't know that they are not just a bunch of strange drag queens, you know, bearded nuns that run around with pancake makeup. They actually fund a lot of other organizations and efforts. And they're just an incredible, you know, an incredible group. And I'm so glad that we started off with that.
Well, you know, the day that activism ceases to have some kind of sense of humor and some sense of camp in our community, you know, then I might have to retire because like, it makes it much easier to deal with all the other miserable things that we have to deal with and all the miserable anti-queer people that we have to deal with all the time and all the fights that we're fighting, you know. You know, it is one of the things that I kind of miss a bit about, you know, nostalgia, you know, when the activism community was smaller. And I mean, we all still kind of know each other, but it's been awesome to see this explosion of activism, you know, especially at the local level where, you know, especially kids, and you talk about not wanting to raise money for youth. I mean, we have teenagers out there who are doing incredible activism. And we had a 16-year-old trans girl testify for the Equality Act at a Senate judicial hearing. And she was fantastic, Stella. Stella Keating is her name. And she works with an organization called Gender Cool, which is all trans and non-binary kids who are in their teens, who are out there telling their stories, and they're positive, they're thriving, they're not just surviving, they've got accepting families, and they really want to be role models and show kids and families what a difference it makes to have an accepting and unconditionally loving family and what that does for a young queer person, whether they're trans or gay or bi.
Now, there's a lot more younger activists, I think, now than there used to be.
Yep.
And of course, again, you have social media partially to blame or credit for that, however you want to look at it, because that's where they are. That's where they're getting, you know, the information and chatting with their friends, just like we used to do in a bar. They're doing it online on their phone while they're, you know, riding the bus or whatever they're doing. So I think that kind of helps them get into the loop a little bit earlier. And of course, there's so much news out there about transgender youth and non-binary youth that you see, you know, news articles and everything, that it becomes real to them. When I was 12 years old, there were no stories out there about some, you know, boy who wanted to change his gender to female or change his name to a female name. You didn't hear about that kind of stuff. Now you do.
Well, I mean, I think it's interesting. I mean, as a young girl who was a tomboy and still is, theoretically, ostensibly, you know, I was very lucky because you're right. There were not a lot of representations in media for me, whether film or news or, and, you know, and if they were, they were really primarily negative. But I was very lucky to have my dad and my mom's brother went to college with a phenomenal woman who, you know, they all went to Queens College here in New York. And she had a female partner and they were a gay couple. And they were never like super out, but they got more out as they got older because suddenly they had me nudging them. I had them as role models. I knew that they were a couple. They were a part of the family. And it makes such an incredible difference. You know, I've been so blessed to not grow up with a lot of the negativity and baggage, frankly, that a lot of folks have because they grew up in rejecting households. That's a really hard thing to get over. And what's really good is that we have new generations coming forward that haven't had to deal with that experience, you know, my daughter included. And so, you know, they're much more confident. They're much more secure. They're much less sort of identity-based, you know, like, I mean, I know you were saying, you know, we've added all the letters. It's really important because we are a very diverse community. And we now have a generation of kids who are like, I don't want any letters. I don't want to be put in a box. My gender identity is fluid. My sexual orientation is fluid. And isn't that what we've been striving for the whole time, is liberation, is being free to be whoever you are and not having to have labels, right? So it's really interesting to me. And you're right that kids can now socialize in spaces that obviously they could never have before. I mean, an isolated kid in, you know, rural Alabama, they have access to the internet. They can connect with other young people.
Right.
I mean, I work with New York City Pride, and they do a youth pride. And in 2019, when we had the 50th anniversary of Stonewall and we did World Pride, we had 5 million people in New York City. We had 10,000 kids in Central Park for youth pride. It was amazing. Obviously everything's virtual, but the silver lining of, you know, having to deal with this pandemic and things being virtual is that this year Youth Pride is now doing over 100 watch parties in almost every state in the country, including Alaska, where kids are going to get together, you know, in a safe space and be able to watch the live stream of Youth Pride from New York City. And, you know, to me, that's the incredible gift of the internet. Yes, there are difficult and dark and challenging sides to social media and the internet. But for me, that's been a huge silver lining. And I hear it all the time from young people who, you know, can get access to information, to people and parents as well, and families who can connect with each other in a way that they would never have been able to before.
Yeah. And that's part of the reason that I started, you know, with this project, trying to capture as many stories as possible, is because a lot of people, younger people especially, they don't understand what the evolution was from when I came out or when you came out to what is now. Mm-hmm. And by, you know, recounting some of these stories, talking about what the bar scene was like, talking about what the activism scene was like, I think it helps give them a perspective without being too, you know, didactic, not trying to preach to them, but just let them hear the stories as if their uncle or grandmother or somebody was telling them, and absorb the information and kind of appreciate how the bar scene and the activism scene kind of pushed us to where we are now in a completely different world.
Well, you know, I have always been someone who cares about history. I mean, the reality is they don't know because they're not taught, you know, unless they have the gumption to start, you know, looking things up on the internet and reading gay history books. But in schools, there are very few states, like a handful, I think 4 or 5, that have mandated an inclusive curriculum around LGBTQ history and individuals. Like, if you're going to talk about the March on Washington in the 60s with Martin Luther King, you need to talk about the fact that it was organized by Bayard Rustin. Let's talk about the fact that Bayard Rustin was a gay man. That doesn't happen, right? So we don't know our history unless we seek it out. And I was very lucky living in D.C. in the 90s. I got to know Frank Kameny and Barbara Giddings, and actually Bayard Rustin's partner, who lives here in New York now. And so many people that I always say, like, I stand on their shoulders. Like, they talked about what it was like in the 40s and the 50s, the first, you know, pickets in front of the White House in 1965, the year I was born. I mean, I can appreciate that. And so I try to pay it forward and talk to young people about what it was like in the 80s and the 90s. I mean, one of the things I do a lot is, because of the incredible number of productions of the Laramie Project that happen around the country, especially in high schools and colleges. So the Laramie Project, the basically, you know, talks about the town and the story of Matthew Shepard's murder. That happened in 1998. And just last month, I was at a high school right here in Montclair, New Jersey, where I live. I met with the actors, and then I did a talk back after the play. And at one point, you know, I used to always say, like, well, how old were you when this happened? I don't ask that anymore, because guess what? They weren't born yet.
Right.
They're in high school. And so it's incredible that, you know, they were so moved to tears to hear me talk about what it was really like to be on the ground in Laramie in 1998 and sit through the trials and work with his parents and, you know, see the platform that was created where we could talk about hate crimes more, because hate crimes are still an epidemic in this community that we don't talk about as much because it, you know, they happen to mostly Black and brown trans women. that to me is like, that's the value. And I said it actually at this talk back, and I'm a little bit of a crier anyway, but I teared up because I said, you know, this is what gives me hope. I mean, these kids, a couple of them came out after the performance to the entire school. And I don't think they were out to everybody, you know, and they said it, how much it meant for them to be part of this play because they're part of the LGBTQ community. Or one young man who said, I have two moms. This means so much to me because if this play teaches us to hate less and helps us understand better what it's like to be queer in America, you're helping my family. I mean, that to me is what really gives me hope and goosebumps.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, a little bit of trivia. When I was doing this research, I've uncovered so far in the U.S. about 1,300 gay bars that used to exist and don't anymore.
Yeah.
But no one anywhere ever has been able to identify a single gay bar in the state of Wyoming.
Right. There wasn't. You know, that's part of the story of the Beginning Larry Project is the limo driver who says when he picked up Matt, the first thing Matt said to him was, don't call me Matthew. Don't call me Mr. Shepherd. Call me Matt. And I'm gay. And we're going to a gay bar. And that meant that they were going to Fort Collins, Colorado, because there is no gay bar in Wyoming. And there,
right. And there still isn't to this day.
Still not to this day. Unless enough of us go in a bar, it becomes a gay bar.
Right. Gay by proxy.
That's right.
So after you went through these career experiences, you know, working in the corporate world, getting back into the gay scene, you also started your own business called Target Q.
Yep.
And Target Q, as I understand it, is a public relations firm that deals largely with LGBTQ issues. Is that correct?
Pretty much only. I mean, I would call what Target Q does as public interest PR because we work almost exclusively with nonprofit queer organizations and projects like books, films, you know, not fiction, but like, you know, either memoirs, autobiographies, educational books, and documentary films a lot, to really continue to do what I did at GLAAD. I mean, you know, we have Target Q has the same mission as GLAAD, is to promote fair, accurate, inclusive representations of the LGBTQ community. And we do it through our clients. And so, I mean, I've been blessed. I've worked with dozens and dozens, hundreds of organizations, some very, very small, and then some incredibly large. Like, I mean, I've worked with HRC, I've worked with the task force, worked with New York City Pride, and been part of some of the largest events that our community has ever done. And I've also had the opportunity to work with small organizations that have a really incredible story to tell. I mean, I remember when Gender Cool was very tiny. I remember the Point Foundation, which is now really large. They had 8 scholars and they came to me for help because they wanted to become more visible. And I will never forget the day that first article ran in the New York Times about the Point Foundation. And then we just went from there. And now they are a national organization. They have provided millions of dollars in scholarships to hundreds of scholars all around the country and literally around the world, as well as a mentoring program. And they're an incredible organization. And I feel like that's, you know, it's not dissimilar to the work I did at GLAAD at all. It just, I've been able to do it as an entrepreneur, I guess.
On your own terms.
And on my own terms. Yes, that's right. Yeah. Sometimes I say no to people occasionally. You know, they got to fit with my values. I don't work with folks who just want their name in the paper for the sake of having their name in the paper. I like to work with folks who want to make a difference, you know? And that's, I've been very, very blessed to be able to not only do that, but do it successfully for about 15 years.
Now, I understand you also have a connection with an alcoholic beverage brand that you've now been connected with. And, you know, over the years, I remember in decades past, whenever a gay man thought about vodka, it was always a brand from Sweden. That was always the first one that seemed to embrace the community.
Yes, they were.
But here in the last few years, I've noticed that Stoli has taken a deep dive and really put some thought into what they do with the gay community. I mean, they're not just putting rainbow stripes on their bottle and waving a flag at pride events. They're putting some thought into it. And what was particularly interesting to me is that a couple of years ago, they did a commemorative bottle that had a portrait of Harvey Milk on it some time back, and which was kind of thoughtful to pick a person who had some relevance as opposed to just saying, we're going to put a rainbow unicorn on the label. They really put some thought behind it. And as they came into this year and decided they were going to do that again, they had a Brazilian artist who did an incredible mural. That also focuses on Harvey Milk and create a second Harvey Milk edition collector's bottle this year. How do you feel about that? And how are you involved in that conversation, if at all?
So they came to me through some of my colleagues at Rivendell Media, which you're probably familiar with. They work with LGBTQ media. They're an advertising firm and agency.
Absolutely. In fact, I'm supposed to be interviewing Todd Evans in the next few days.
I'm having lunch with him Friday. I'll
tell him I said hi. Because he's
a great guy. He's right here in New Jersey as well. We're he's like 10 minutes away from where my wife teaches elementary school, just south of us here. And I also know Patrick from who has represented and worked with Stoli for more than a few years now.
Yeah, he told me today when I was talking to him to tell you he loves you.
Ugh, I love Patrick. He's just, you know, he is the perfect example of the kind of person that I love. He's himself. He's unapologetic. He's unapologetically Patrick, you know? So when they came to me and said they wanted some help with this, you know, I grew up on Long Island, just like Harvey did. You know, obviously I know the history of Harvey's work and advocacy and the tragic way that he died. I know Stuart, his nephew, pretty well. Also another Long Islander. And I certainly know the good work of the Harvey Milk Foundation. And so when they came to me and said, can you help us out for a few months? I mean, the interesting thing about this is you're right. This is not just about a bottle of vodka with a rainbow flag on it. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but I just love that they have embraced taking our history. Because there was a bottle that they did in 2019 to honor the 50th anniversary of Stonewall. I have that one too. I told you I don't drink. So these have not even been cracked open. So come over for a vodka tonic. I have it sitting here that it's stunning. And I love what Oz did is that he took that iconic photo of Harvey Milk at Pride with the sign. And instead of in the background having the folks who were really behind him in the '70s, he modernized it. And so the label is absolutely stunning. I mean, you can find it at Stoli.com all through June. And the thing that we're doing this year, which is a little different, is they're going global. So it's now available globally. And over the next year or so, especially as things open up more, they're going to be going to several other countries, including Taiwan, to do murals. I mean, it's really interesting. I've done not a lot, but quite a bit of global work. I worked with Global Pride. And of course, with World Pride, I met people from all over the world. And one of the really interesting things is that there are two very American iconic pieces of gay history that are known internationally.
And I guess
if you say Stonewall, everybody knows what that is. In fact, there are organizations in other countries that are called Stonewall because of Stonewall, and people know Harvey Milk. And so, you know, I think for that reason, you know, his sort of iconic status, historical status, Stoli recognizes that and they're honoring that by doing this. And I love that. I think that it brings additional meaning. I mean, when I worked at GLAAD, I remember that we had very few corporate sponsors. There were very few companies that were able and willing. In fact, Absolute Vodka and American Airlines were two of our most critical sponsors. And, you know, Absolute was incredibly important in helping us with events, obviously, and providing product for events. And then American Airlines provided us with travel vouchers. I mean, that's how I got to Laramie. That's how I traveled all over the country to do media trainings or to deal with any other crisis or good thing or bad thing or whatever I had to deal with, was because of the generosity of American Airlines and Absolute. So, you know, I mean, I love that we've now progressed to the point where we have so many more companies that are willing to do this and do it in a really thoughtful meaningful way, not, you know, not slap a rainbow on something and expect us to buy it. I mean, that just doesn't cut it anymore. You have to give back. You have to do more. You have to create a safe environment for your queer employees. You know, there's so many things that a corporation really needs to do to have credibility. And so it's nice to see our history recognized in this way. And also, again, like you said, I mean, having, you know, going beyond the bottle, right? I mean, having murals, having, you know, doing so many more things to really help educate people and tell the story, like you said, of history of Harvey Milk, because again, it's not taught in schools. And it really should be, because our history is American history.
Right. And the Stolle approach at Pride, at some of the Prides, you know, you were talking about Patrick before. First of all, how many brands have a global LGBT ambassador, you know, the queen of gay Stolle or whatever you want to call it?
Pretty much that's what Patrick is. Yeah. He's the queen of Stolle. Yes.
But, and we love that. And not only have someone like him, but then have him recruit people to come work the events who are obviously gay and obviously enthusiastic, not just some, you know, internal PR staff that is told you have to wear a rainbow stripe polo shirt today and go to this event. I mean, they enthusiastically embrace the whole concept and do it extremely well.
Yeah, they do.
The Key West Stolle cocktail event is just know, as flamboyant as you can get for a brand that is kind of associated with, you know, an Eastern European product is, you know, what people have in their mind when you think of vodka.
Stolle. Right. Vodka period. Yes, that's true.
Yeah. Just in general. But I think it's been incredible, and it's incredible to hear some of the stories that you've had about your history and, you know, kind of the different experiences you went through and the organizations you worked with. And I'm so glad you took the time to, you know, be able to sit down and talk to us about this today. So more people can hear these stories, and hopefully as time goes on, you know, maybe the entire world will know exactly what has gone on over the last 30, 40, 50 years of gay history.
Well, and thank you for doing this work and archiving it, because I'm sure you know who Eric Marcus is, you know, the someone else who has really devoted his life to archiving and capturing the stories of pioneers and individuals in the LGBTQ community that, you know, have incredible stories to tell, whether they are, you know, big deal activists or whether they are just, you know, regular folks living their lives, to really document what our lives are about, what our lives are like. It's so important, and we don't do it enough. So I appreciate you doing this.
Well, thank you. And if you know anybody who is in the archival world or that, you know, has stories to tell about their gay experiences, I'm open to, you know, all possibilities. I have a very diverse list of people that I have and will continue to include in this project. So it doesn't have to be somebody that's nationally recognized or, you know, had some big stake in the game. But I also, as part of my goal on the website, is to include as many other archival projects as possible, because one of the things that is a little bit annoying to me as I went through this course of research is you find an archive from, I don't know, New Hope, Pennsylvania, and it doesn't reference the one from Philadelphia. You know, it doesn't
around the corner. Have to,
right. And the whole object of saving these stories is not so that I can say I have the biggest collection of stories that I have on my computer. It's so that everybody can find them. So if I don't have all the information, I want them to go to your website or your friend's website or your cousin's website and find them there, because I can't possibly put it all in one place.
Well, you know, hopefully we'll get to the day where there is an LGBTQ history museum on the Mall.
Let's hope so.
As there should be.
And digitally.
Of course. Well, everything now is, yeah. I mean, especially in the last year, digital tours of museums have been, are a thing. But absolutely. I mean, I really feel very strongly about, I mean, I saved all kinds of things. I have things in, you know, like archival storage, because, you know, we're going to want to have those someday when we do have a museum, you know, when you have flyers from marches that, you know, happened well before the internet was a thing, right? You know, I have the little index cards that they gave us to allow us entry into the courtroom during the Matthew Shepard trials. Nobody has those. Those need to be saved. They need to be preserved because they are our history, our collective history.
They absolutely are. And that concludes another segment of the Gabe Archives podcast. You can find more podcasts at GabeArchives.com/podcast. We also have more information about this podcast and links to the other podcasts we have completed. We hope you enjoy your trip down memory lane.